John, welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. We're broadcasting here live from the Creatures, Crimes, and Creativity Conference, Austin Camacho's conference, C3, which I absolutely love.
Yes.
I'm happy to have you here to talk with you again today.
Thank you.
I'm going to read your bio for our viewers watching.
You can shorten it any way you want.
No, it's come on. I want to give you short thrift. You've done a lot here. Award-winning novelist, writing coach, and manuscript editor John Dedekis is a former editor on CNN's The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer. Dedekis is the author of 6 mystery suspense thriller novels. In his most recent novel, Enemies Domestic, protagonist Lark Chadwick is pregnant White House press secretary at the time in the not-too-distant future when abortion is a crime and the president is a dictator. Dedekis is a former White House correspondent, regularly leads writing workshops at literary centers and writers' conferences. He is also the host of the video podcast One-to-One with John Dedekis on YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Originally from La Crosse, Wisconsin, Dedekis now lives with his wife Cindy in Baltimore, Maryland. In his spare time, what little he has of it, Dedekis is a jazz and rock and roll drummer.
A rank amateur one.
So welcome, John.
Thank
it's
you.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
You've been a regular guest at the C3 for a long time, right?
Yes.
How many conferences does this make for you?
I've tried to figure that out. It's got to be at least 10, but it might be a few fewer because of COVID.
Wow. So what do you get out of these conferences? Let's start there.
Well, I think that probably what anybody gets is the opportunity to mix with other writers. It's an opportunity. It's fellowship, but it's also craft, and you're picking up tips and tricks, and you're learning from the experience of other people as well.
So you're 6 novels in. How much more could you be learning from other authors that are here? Do you pick something up from conversations offline, or do you do it from the craft panels, or where does this help you?
It really can help any at any time, and it's unexpected, but you know, the panels are tremendous because there's so much experience in the room, basically hundreds of years of experience, and based on those experiences, there's always a few nuggets that you pick up and can apply, and then there's always the bar. You know, the bar is where it really happens.
You know, people talk about BarCon, right? Where
BarCon.
People go honestly, it's I think it's a place where people let down. You know, when they're on stage or when they're you know, in a panel, they're up a little bit, they're presenting, and when they get into the bar, you know, all the real feelings and the real person comes out.
Well, and it's true, and yet, I mean, I've been to a lot of writers' conferences, and it's not one of these blowout, you know, Bacchanals, you know, it's just relaxed, and you don't have to be a drinker. You know, you can have ginger ale or water or whatever. It's the fellowship of it.
I spent 4 hours at the bar last night and had cranberry and soda water.
Exactly. See, do it. Be him.
You know,
be Jeff.
But it's true. Honestly, I think one of the reasons a lot of people, I mean, some people drink a lot, right? But
sure.
A lot of reason people don't is because of that camaraderie. And also, you really want to talk to people, you
right.
know, like it's because how often as a writer, how often do you as a writer get to like spend time with other writers?
Well, that's the thing. Writing is solitary. It's you and the computer and you and your creative muse or whatever. And so these opportunities are golden. To be able to see people who have become friends and encouragers and supporters. And so it's invaluable. It's priceless.
So do you have goals when you come to a conference, or let me rephrase it. Have you, when you first started, did you have goals versus now? Like, what's the plan when you come here?
Well, when I first started going to writers' conferences, it was just to get published. You know, to meet an agent, to find someone who was willing to champion my work, who wasn't in love with me or my mom or somebody like that, somebody who had a distant relationship. And then you come to these things to just learn more. I'm at a point now where I make a conscious decision, or at least a hope, of being able to have at least one in-depth conversation.
About what?
Usually, it's an opportunity to get to know someone else. What makes them tick? And And I'm a very curious person, so I get to follow my curiosity because I find that people, if given permission, will really share some of the deep stuff that motivates them and defines who they are. Because writing is personal. And I think the better you know yourself, the better you're going to be as a writer. And so I'm among people who have cultivated that relationship with their own creativity. And so the more I can lap up that experience and that wisdom from other people, the better.
Let me ask you, though, how much, like, it's hard to be introspective. And how much do most writers that you speak to, do you feel like they've done the work? Like, you know, when people are writing, it's always very personal. But have they dug down deep and found that theme or that thing that they want to work on that they put into the writing? Or does it just sort of come out organically and they haven't really thought about it?
Based on the conversations I've been having and what I've been hearing in the panels I'm going to, is that for the most part, it's spooky. It's something that's magical that people, it's not that they're being introspective. It's that they're being carefree, that they are taking that risk and moving their fingers, even though they have no idea what is going to come out when they type. And that's something that I want to be able to do more freely than I do. I've gotten a taste of what that's like, but the more I hear it, the more I'm willing to give it a try and take risks. So knowing that you might fail.
Are you talking about flow state where the words are just pouring out of somebody, or are you just talking about silencing that inner critic to get that first draft out on paper?
I think it's both. I think that the silencing of the inner critic is critical. But it happens, I think, if you're willing to write without thinking and to, in a sense, transcribe the voices that show up, translate whatever the scene is that you see in your mind's eye, getting that down and bypass that inner critic. It's the act of writing that keeps that flow going. And it's when you sit back and start getting critical that you can freeze up and it can stymie the process.
So nothing can be more personal than having your imagination creating some story out of whole cloth and maybe a theme that's something you've been working on or a problem you want to talk about. So why is it that writers, and it happens to everybody, introduce that critic to start self-doubt or second-guessing what they're putting on the paper while they're in the middle of channeling that story?
Let me see. Rephrase that.
Okay,
I want to make sure I understand.
Story comes from your subconscious, right?
Yep.
And it's flowing through the writer. You're saying, let yourself go, just as you see the images, channeling the story into the keyboard.
Right.
But one of the obstacles to that is the critic, right?
Sure.
And so beyond the, you know, I want better prose, or I want to do this, people get self-doubt. People start, you know, having imposter syndrome. People start worrying about how things will be received before they've even written it. Why? Because it's such a personal thing when they're channeling that subconscious. Do they allow themselves to become the obstacle?
Well, I think they allow themselves to become the obstacle if they become critical too soon. It's the fear of failure, the fear of being judged, the fear of not being perfect. And the best way around that is to realize that the first draft doesn't have to be perfect. It's the discovery draft. It's what you're discovering what's in there. And I think that if you realize or remind yourself when you're starting to freeze up, when you're starting to get critical, realize that it's fine to be critical later when you have something actually on the page that you can be critical of. There's plenty of room for criticism, but at least in the initial stage, get it out, get it down, and then look at it once you've had a chance to get it onto the page.
So you do counseling services where you mentor authors. What are there any common like points of friction that you find amongst these people that you counsel that are causing them issues and preventing them from finishing projects?
As near as I can tell, no. I think that there's a little resistance at first because you can become so enamored with your writing that you're reluctant to make any changes because it's so precious. But I think that the people who have been the most resistant are the people who don't understand the business, and that there are certain hoops you need to jump through. There are certain parameters that you need to meet in order to be marketable. And if a person doesn't understand that, agents, for example, they see so many manuscripts, in a lot of cases, they will make a decision to reject you based on the first page, which is seems unfair, but at the same time, they see so many things. And so one of the things I try to do is to help a person identify what it is that's going to cause an agent to reject you prematurely. You may have written a great story, but you have to hook them and intrigue them and entice them on the first page.
See, you know, you talk about writers and this and the marketability and how they may be resistant to that because they feel like it's interfering with their art or the stories that first came to them. But in another sense, isn't marketability really just saying, let's put the story into a form that will make people want to read it, and therefore, you know, it's not interfering with the art, it's making it art that people can consume.
Exactly. And I mean, if you think about some of the masters of the past, you know, Faulkner, for instance, he'd probably never get published today. He's the king of the run-on sentence. You know, we live in an era of short attention spans. Yep. And a lot of the stories that, you know, we grew up on, that we love, might not make the cut because of the so many choices that people have with how they're going to spend their time and money. And so you have to adapt to where society is now. And if you have that, you know, legacy project or that vanity project, sure, do that. You know, knock yourself out, please yourself. But if you really want to get published professionally, then you'll need to make perhaps compromises with yourself in order to reach more people.
So, I mean, I agree with that completely. I think that's really smart. There is a flip side to it, though, right? It's a double-edged sword in that the same gatekeepers who are saying something isn't marketable also may be judging it based on prior performance of other work.
Oh, man.
So if something comes in that's different, a lot of times, and we've heard this from a lot of bestsellers, right, where everybody rejected them because it was genre mixing or it was something else. And then, of course, it becomes a bestseller, and then everybody wants that thing that they've been rejecting because now they know it works.
I wonder if that happens more in Hollywood than it does in publishing. You know, Hollywood is very risk averse. It's also very expensive. And so people are risking a lot of money. I think, and I may be wrong on this, but I think that in publishing, there is more of a willingness to take a risk. And I think that writing is probably, if you want to get on the big screen or the little screen, I think the best way to do that is to write a really good book, because Hollywood likes to adapt print.
Are you seeing any in the people that you counsel or the young writers that you're interacting with, are you seeing the same mistakes from people?
Yes. Probably the biggest mistake is a writer will start off with a really intriguing, interesting character, but then what they'll do is they'll start to throw backstory in, to throw context in, to throw atmospherics in, and you don't have time to set up the story. What you want to do is to get the characters talking to each other and make the reader want to know more about them. Drop little nuggets that suggest that there's more to come. And what ends up happening is that, you know, a rookie writer will feel that they have to explain things and tell the story instead of show the story.
So how long did it take you to learn, like that's one lesson, right? How long did it take you to learn these lessons of what makes something publishable?
Oh, it took 10 years for me to get published, to get the agent that I've got. And I kept making mistakes. I was rejected like 39 times. The manuscript for the first novel went through 14 major drafts. And so I tell my students, take good notes and I'll save you 9 years in the process.
So how do you handle rejection? Because that's something that literally New York Times bestsellers, everyone deals with at different points in their career.
Right. I think you can, what I try to do is learn, use that as an opportunity to learn. Often you don't really get specific reasons why you're being rejected, which means then that you'll probably need to go to beta readers, people who are in your life who will tell you where the shortcomings are. You don't have to pay these people. And they're not rejecting you so much as they are letting you know when they dropped out of the story, when it wasn't interesting, when it was confusing, all the things that are really happening when an agent is reading it, because the agent is, in a sense, by proxy, the reader. And so when you can get feedback from real readers, that's golden. And then it doesn't feel so bad because you're also being given guidance on how you can fix it.
How many beta readers do you recommend a writer gets for a particular manuscript?
I recommend about three, and preferably people with whom you don't share a bed or a last name, because either they'll break your spirit or they'll be so complimentary that it won't be any good.
Do you think beta readers should be writers, or does it matter? Should they be readers first?
I think you probably want a mix, but I think readers especially, because because that's really your audience. And, you know, you want it to be a satisfying read, and a writer is going to look at it from with a different set of lenses. And, you know, and they're going to be looking at it of, well, I would do it this way, as opposed to a reader who is just there for the reading experience.
Is it important to find readers who read in that specific genre?
I think that helps, because genre means story type. And so each genre has certain beats that have to be met, certain story expectations. And a person who reads romance knows how a romance is supposed to feel. Same with a mystery or a thriller or whatever. So a person who is steeped in that genre will be able to give you quality feedback based on their what their gold standard is for a good mystery, thriller, romance, or whatever.
So a writer gets, say, three beta readers. One of them's a writer, another author. Two of them read that genre significantly. What should their instructions be to a beta reader? Like, what should they be getting back from the beta reader?
I mean, first, you want to give them permission to tell you what's not working and to be specific. You know, you're not necessarily getting them to give you find typos or anything like that. It's, you know, help me understand if there were things that didn't make sense. When were you ready to turn out the light? What was confusing? Those are the things. If there's a specific thing you're a little iffy about, you know, you may want to ask a more specific question, or you may want to shut up about that and see if anybody brings it up on their own.
Have you ever had a piece of your manuscript that you had that nagging doubt about and left it in? And what happened? Did you get feedback from beta readers or editors, or was everyone okay with it?
A little of both. You know, there were times where I knew there were weaknesses and they were found. And there were other times where I thought, oh man, this is so cheesy. And everybody said, oh, this is great.
So what did you do? Because based on the beta reader feedback, do you leave it in, or do you go with your gut that is wrong?
You do not have to take everybody's advice. You know, you are still the final arbiter of your story. And I take everybody's comments seriously, but there are times when I go, nope, I'm gonna leave it in. And there are others where I go, yeah, you're right, I need to rework that.
So this is a brutal business,
yes,
right?
As
evidenced by all the writers who are trying to get published, and you're taking 10 years, right, to get an agent, yeah, and get published. So what is it that motivates you to be a storyteller?
Writing, for me, is its own reward. It's just the process of doing it, the joy of discovery, the kick that you get when someone you don't know reads and likes and is moved by something that you've written. And so that then encourages me to do it again. So it's the act of writing. I can't not do it.
And I've heard that a lot from, like, people I believe are true storytellers, right? Like, they, right, no matter what, even if only their family and friends read it, they're going to keep writing because,
yeah,
they have to. They are storytellers.
You got to lower your expectations. You know, it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. You know, there's something, I don't know what the exact statistic is, but it's like 20,000 books a day are being published. So the competition is fierce, and the chances of you being a best-selling author or being a household name are infinitesimal. But it's the joy of being able to do it, to having that sense of accomplishment, to even have a few people say, this is really good. Thank you.
So what is it about a reader you don't know? So, you know, it's not a previously existing relationship that somebody's just loving you and so they're telling you. Somebody you don't know. What is it about the uniqueness of the written word where you're writing something with a picture in your mind and a reader is reading something with a different picture in their mind? So it's almost two different but related experiences. What is it about that magic that happens that's so intimate between a writer and a reader?
Well, I think you said it. It's magic. But I think that there's something about reading that is intimate, and it gets inside you. But the interesting thing is the words stay the same. But if you read the same story a year later, you may see different things. You know, it's not that the story has changed. You've changed. And the fact that the words are there and they're changeless, there's an eternity factor that goes there. There's the eternity of it, and there's the emotional and psychological depth of it. It can get in, words can get inside you.
Have you ever read something that you loved and then years later gone back and read the same thing and had a different experience?
I don't often go back and read something that I've read before, so I don't know if I can speak authoritatively to that.
Do you have themes that come out in your work? Do you have things that you've been thinking about or things that you need to work out or
yes.
things that are just deeply interest you?
Look, yes. And that's something, look, I've been published for 20 years and when I look back over what I've done, I can see more clearly that even though when I first started writing, it was just to get published. But when I go back, I can see that I was working out stuff. My very first novel deals with a car train collision I witnessed as a kid that killed three people, including a kid my age. And it also includes my sister's suicide. I was on the scene that day. And so both of those stories come together in my first novel. So writing it was a catharsis. And so because I write as a series, those experiences impact my protagonist. So grief and loss are part of her character. And that goes with her as she lives her life. It's with me as I live my life. It's part of my identity. So that when I wrote my fourth novel, I was dealing with my son's death from a heroin overdose. And so all of those things, especially grief and loss, are undercurrents that indicate I've been working it out over time. And journalism is another experience that's part of my life. And so I'm writing what I know in terms of career. I'm writing what I know in terms of emotions. And every book that I've written, there's something usually in the subplot that's part of something I'm working through in real life.
And do you know that in the moment, like as you're writing it, or are these things you go back later and look at?
Both. Some of it is conscious. It's like, I really want to work on this. And there are others where I go back and go, oh, interesting. There's a scene in Troubled Water where one of my characters has to identify the body of his daughter who dies in a mountain climbing accident. And I wrote that before my son died and before I had to identify his body in the morgue. And I went back and I read that years later after having that experience. And I mean, it just wiped me out because it was like, I've been there.
Yeah.
Who knew that I was going to be there?
Wow. So I mean, you're touching these points of humanity, right? People at their toughest times and their hardest times. So what is it that's therapeutic about the writing? Is it physically the writing and looking at the words so you're thinking about the issue and kind of processing mentally? Or is it the actual like stating explicitly what the thing is that's causing you so much grief, for example, that you're excising it in a way? Do you know what is it that creates a therapy?
I think that, I mean, I went through grief counseling and one of the things that I found valuable about grief counseling is that I was able to tell my grief counselor anything. And there was a time where I said, you know, there's something I need to tell you. And the only two people I've ever told this to are dead. And she flinched. And I said, that's not why they're dead. and then I told her, and it was like a major burden was lifted. And I think that if you then take that experience and apply it to the writing, you've got your characters talking to each other. And so there's something about conversation, and I'm not talking small talk, I'm talking cosmic talk, where they're having conversations that deal with life and death, existence, meaning. And when you articulate those things, you are helping to find meaning for your characters, your story. The story has to mean something. And I think that's what's part of grief counseling. It's finding meaning out of what otherwise feels meaningless.
Is it easier when you're finding this meaning and exploring the grief when you're doing it through a fictional character?
Is
it almost like using a puppet, you know, like something else?
I think you're right. And I think this actually works on a lot of levels, not just in terms of grief, because a lot of writers are either shy or introverts. And I've come across some writer friends who write under a pseudonym because they're shy. And they've told me it's like taking on a new persona, just like an actor does. And it's like they become a new person, maybe a braver version of themselves. And so but I think the puppet analogy is perfect, because there's a bit of distance, because it's not you, it's your character, but it's still you.
So, you know, years ago, if I heard someone was writing under a pseudonym, I would have thought, well, they're afraid the work will be bad and they don't want to bring on the criticism, which I guess could be a small part of it. But now I understand, like, how personal all writing is, right? Because it's coming out of your brain and it's right. So unique to you.
Well, and they might not want to get sued, too.
Well, that's true. Does that level of your inner thoughts, your grief, your things that you're experiencing, does that make it harder for you to put that out into the public square? Because you're not just excising it in a room by yourself, you're now sharing it with strangers.
Yeah, but you don't see them reading it. So it's personal, but it's still removed a little bit. And so and maybe part of it is just the kind of person I am. I mean, I'm a journalist, and so that means, you know, theoretically, you should be concerned about the truth. And so I think that that's part of what life is. Life is full of loss. And it doesn't mean just the loss of a child. It can be the loss of a pet, a job, a relationship, health, innocence. And we all have that. And so I think it's important just to mind the pain, move toward it instead of anesthetizing it. And in doing so, I think we're tapping into something and giving the reader an opportunity to live vicariously through the story.
Have you ever heard from a reader who's been touched by your work because maybe they were suffering some kind of grief that your work helped them through?
Yeah. In dribs and drabs, I mean, there was one person who said, you know, I was reading this on the bus and I was, you know, crying. And I think the act of crying is an emotional safety valve. When I wrote Bullet in the Chamber, I cried the whole time I wrote it. I think there is a catharsis. There's a freedom, an inner cleansing that can happen when we allow our emotions to kind of clear out, as opposed to bottling them up. Because they don't go away, they just corrode.
So we talked a little bit about how personal this was, right, and sharing that. But when you're touching somebody who's been through something similar and they're telling you about how they cried and what that meant to them, that must raise it to a whole other level, right? Because you're not just connecting with them and through this fictional story, you're actually helping them with their lives and their own grief. You're making their lives better, people you don't even know, who you've never met.
Well, but I have to say, it's not why I'm doing it, because these books are not prescriptive. It's not like they're preaching, you know, you should feel this way or whatever, because I think that if there's any healing or solace or comfort or whatever, that's something that is something that the reader can bring to it on their own. And I'm just, in a sense, providing a catalyst to maybe lance the boil.
Oh, I like that. So when you're writing something, you say, you know, you cry every day, right? You're writing this incredibly emotional, deeply personal thing. I mean, I guess, is it just a catharsis that keeps you going? Because it sounds excruciating, right? It's hard enough to write a book, but now you're writing a book that's dragging you over the emotional coals, right?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, the books aren't just doom and gloom. I mean, I'm still putting it against a backdrop of, you know, trying to solve a mystery or trying to stop the bomb from going off or whatever. You know, there's humor in these. There's a scene where my protagonist is going to the White House Correspondents Association dinner. And, you know, it's the nerd prom, right?
Right.
And so there's still the red carpet. And she's reticent to be in the public eye, and you know, ETV is going, "And what are you wearing, Lark?" And she goes, "Old Navy."
So, that's very funny.
Yeah, and so it's not all, you know, just crying onto the page.
Does the darkness in the manuscript make the lightness easier? Does it make it funnier when you're coming after a dark period?
Yes. Yeah. Because look, I mean, and just the point of what I was telling you a minute ago about, you know, telling my grief counselor about the, you know, the people I told who were dead. I mean, that's a funny line.
Yeah. Not for her at the time.
Well, it actually was. I mean, but there's dark humor. I mean, newsrooms are filled with dark humor. Yeah. I can give you an example.
Please.
When Sammy Davis Jr. died, somebody wrote the lead, "He sang, he danced, and today he died," which on one level is, there's a lot of pathos there.
Right.
It's cool that you were able in one sentence to sum up what was going on. But a couple of the writers I worked with thought that was pretty hokey. So what we started to do, whenever a celebrity died, we would start to come up with a lead with that rhythm.
Oh, no.
So, and the first opportunity we had was when George Burns died. I'm in the CNN newsroom, it's in the middle of the night, and the bulletin goes off, George Burns died. And we immediately had a contest to see who could come up with the best lead. And the one that won was, "He smoked, he joked, and today he croaked." That did not make air.
I don't know anyone who would probably enjoy that more than George Burns.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Like, he would appreciate the humor in that for sure.
Yeah. Or the one for George Harrison. It didn't have the same rhythm, but the lead was, again, it never appeared on CNN, was, "George Harrison is singing My Sweet Lord this morning. It's a command performance."
Oh, my God.
I know.
But you get, so what is it about, I mean, you see this with cops and military, you see this with journalists, nurses, right, doctors in the ERs. What is it about being faced with, like, the big life and death stuff, the real questions, right, that makes the humor like this come out? Like, what, is it just a coping mechanism?
I think it is. I think it really is. It's sort of the whistling past the cemetery kind of thing. It's like, well, we missed it, you know, we dodged the bullet that time. So yeah, I think that people are resilient, and I think being able to see the humor in life and death, I think, is a saving grace.
So, well, I love that. That's good stuff. So what do you have coming up next?
I'm working on book 7 with my wife. The sixth novel, she was my alpha reader, and it was very much a seat of the pants thing. We came up with the idea. I would write it. She would read it, give me notes, and then I'd work on it. And it was back and forth that way. There's a memoir I've written that basically identifies the pivotal moments in my life that have brought me to where I am. So it's dealing with writing and living. And I'm also expanding my business. I hate to think of myself as a business, but I'm now doing more keynote speeches and writing workshops geared to people who are struggling with grief, to help them use writing as a way to heal. And so it's a lot of what we've already talked about, to help them tap into whatever it is, to find, you know, whether it's poetry or painting, storytelling, or whatever, which can be a way of finding healing in the long run. So I'm looking to talk to corporations that have wellness programs, veterans groups, hospitals, hospices, grief groups. There are any number of venues that I'm looking now to speak to.
And if somebody was interested in that, where would they find you?
Best way to do that is through my website, which is myname.com, johndedakis.com, J-O-H-N, D as in dog, E, D as in dog, A, K-I-S as in Sam, johndedakis.com. All the stuff you need is there, including how to get through to me by web, email.
Well, your writing isn't just good, but I think it's very mission oriented too. You've got some good stuff involved there.
Thank you. Coming from you, that's huge.
Well, thank you so much, John. This has been a real pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Good job, and keep writing.